Welcome back to the Audace Opera interview podcast series for Athanasius Contramundum. This is always Ryan Grant, your host, and today is the 11th of October, 2015, and we're joined on the line from across the ocean in Germany by Konstantin Molitor. Konstantin, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ron.
Today we're going to talk about a really important subject that bears a lot of thought and research. You've seen the book Hitler's Pope by John Cornwell. You've seen the constant reference and the bellyaching by various interest groups that oppose, for example, the beatification or canonization of Pius XII on the grounds of, well, he didn't do anything for the Jews. He was Hitler's buddy. Right, and we often hear things like that, especially in academia. So today we're going to talk about the Third Reich and the Catholic Church. So, Konstantin, how did you come to study this issue, and how did you come to the Catholic faith?
I'm actually a convert. I converted when I was about 24, and my parents are from a Lutheran background, but were never really religious. And my mother converted first, and at some stage she was visiting with a priest and saw a book in his library about the situation of the church in the Third Reich. And I think it must have been Kreutz and Hakenkreuz by Monsignor Johann Neuhäusler, and she had a look at the book, read a few pages, and then noticed that the whole information was quite different from what we are generally taught in German schools or in German society in general about the situation or the positions of the church in Germany took towards Nazism. So she bought book after book on this topic, and I think I've got about 20 books on this topic, all of which she bought. And soon after my own conversion, I immediately started studying this topic, and it's extremely fascinating. Monsignor Neuhäusler, whom I've mentioned earlier, was especially important in documenting the whole situation of the church in Germany, even during the reign of the Nazis. And he wrote a book as an anonymous, which was published in London. It's called The Persecution of the Catholic Church in the Third Reich. It is published by Pelican Publishing Company. I think it's available on Amazon. And I just read what it says. It says on the back, it's a quote from American Magazine, a review of this book. And it says, quote, "Complete and devastating. The facts are authentic and incontrovertible. The documents are likewise authentic and thoroughly substantiated. To anyone who thinks there is no persecution of the Catholic Church in Germany, we recommend this volume." And I also recommend this book to your readers. It's only until the year 1941, of course, because after that, Monsignor Neuhäusler was locked up in Dachau for 4 years until he was liberated, but I hope I can touch on that later on.
Certainly. So let's kind of set the stage for Hitler's rise then. Of course, there's World War I, and many historians have noted that the Carthaginian terms that are imposed by the Allies on Germany in World War I really do set the stage of the economic suffering that will add to Hitler's popularity later. So, but what a lot of people don't know is that Germany was almost completely taken over in a Bolshevist uprising that really was going to be like a second Russia. And it was during a time called Spartacus Week, which people, Americans, might not be familiar with, but Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht and other leading Bolshevists had a paper called Spartacus. And in the opening weeks of January of 1919, they launched a takeover of the government in Berlin, which then brought us Spartacus Week, and then the newly elected National Socialist government had to work establishing corps of returning soldiers that didn't quite know what they were coming back home to in order to put down the uprising, which was just a very near thing. So then we come to Weimar, and a lot of Americans are at least somewhat familiar with the Weimar Republic and a lot of the economic problems that took place there. So in this turmoil, the somewhat nascent Bolshevism, Freikorps, these groups of military, what's the right, militia groups that sometimes work for the government and sometimes don't. And there's various elements of chaos, plus all the payments that have to go back to France and Britain and the United States. So in this mix, how does Hitler come to the fore in national politics?
Actually, I would like to start with who Hitler was and how he came to Germany, because I think most people probably know that he was in fact Austrian. He was from the city of Braunau, which is a city right on the border between Austria and Bavaria, that is between Germany and Austria. And he grew up in a family that was, he loved his mother extremely, and his father was often described as rather brutal and probably also a free thinker, in the sense that he was against the Catholic faith. And Hitler lost his mother at the age of 15, and before that, according to a German priest, Monsignor Georg May, at some point he lost his Catholic faith. And he then went on to move to Vienna, where he started to get involved with this, or to read Völkisch material, those books by right-wing extremist groups that were often anti-Semitic and often anti-Catholic. And Hitler then decided to move to Germany right before the war, because he didn't want to serve in the Habsburg army, because he said it wasn't a national German army, but he would have to serve with Slavs and all those other peoples of the Habsburg Empire. So he moved to Germany. He had actually become an artist by then, I think. And then the war started, and Hitler was in the situation that he could get deported back to Austria, because he they had a treaty, the German Empire and the Austrian Empire had a treaty to exchange people that didn't want to serve in the armed forces. So Hitler all of a sudden declared himself as a volunteer to the German army. And later on, after the war, Hitler became more involved in politics. He was some type of propaganda speaker, and around the early 1920s, he came into contact with Mr. Dietrich Eckart, who was a member of the pretty well-known and somewhat legendary Thule Society. And through Dietrich Eckart, I think he got into contact with two other members of the Thule Society, Anton Drexler and Karl Harrer. They ran a small, somewhat obscure socialist but right-wing party, the German Workers' Party, or the Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, DAP. And Hitler and Karl Harrer, one of those founders of the DAP, got into an argument of leadership, because Harrer was in favor of keeping the DAP strictly clandestine, and he wanted to form a some type of secret society, like the Thule Society, in fact, was. And Hitler was in favor of making this a mass movement. And so somehow Harald got ousted, and Hitler came into power, and then in 1921 and 1920, he restructured the DAP, and this gave rise to the NSDAP, the National Socialist Workers' Party of Germany, or Nationalsozialistische Deutsche Arbeiterpartei. And from then on, they made an incomparable rise in politics. Hitler, without being a German national, soon had a 9-room apartment in Munich and 2 cars in his garage in the 1920s, where cars were very rare in Germany, or it was rare to have 2 cars, and especially with the whole economic background. Hitler wasn't a German, and he still came into power. This is something that's really interesting. And soon thereafter, there was this famous coup d'etat he tried in Munich on November 9th, 1923. He tried to oust the Bavarian government and march on towards Berlin. Of course, this coup d'etat was suppressed by the armed forces, and many members of the Free Corps or the Freikorps, other right-wing extremist groups or militias that were affiliated with the Nazi Party, many members died. And Hitler was later incarcerated in Landsberg prison, where he wrote his famous book, Mein Kampf.
Fascinating. Now, with his rise to power, what, if anything, was the response of the church?
Before Hitler came to power, the church was actually very anti-national socialism. In 1931, the bishops of 2 of the most important Catholic regions of Germany, the Rhineland and Bavaria, warned the Catholics against National Socialism as long as Nazism displayed a cultural policy that was incompatible with Catholicism. And Cardinal Bertram of Breslau in Silesia, the head of the German Bishops' Conference, said during that time, it was, we Catholics don't know a race religion. Only Christ's revelation that rules this world, that brought the same treasures of faith, the same commandments, the same means of salvation for all peoples. May all peoples and all tribes bring all that is noble in their character to full fruition in the kingdom of Christ. So you see, they were clearly referring to this whole ideology of racism, of extreme exaltation of the own nation to the detriment of other peoples, and of course is clearly incompatible with Nazism. And one Jesuit priest, Rupert Meyer, actually Blessed Rupert Meyer, who had suffered tremendously during the Nazi regime, also warned against Nazis already in the 1920s, when people couldn't really foresee what was going to happen in 1933. So when the Nazis came to power, the bishops were in a quite difficult situation, because they had issued their previous statements, which they surely would want to retract, but at the same time, the Nazis were in charge, and this was a fact that they had to deal with. And soon after the Nazis came to power. The first months were really tense. Your listeners might have heard of the Reichstag fire, where the German parliament was set ablaze, and the whole laws that came after that. And the Nazis soon tried to turn the evangelical church, that is the body of Protestant churches in Germany, of Lutherans, of Calvinists, and smaller Protestant groups. They tried to turn this this religious body into their puppet. And the bishops knew what was going to happen next, that the Nazis would try the same with the Catholic Church. And there were also sporadic acts of violence against Catholic associations, and the Gestapo even occupied and damaged a couple of Catholic publishing houses. And then Hitler, in a very cunning address in the Reichstag that he delivered on March 23rd, 1933, He managed to calm the bishops somehow by saying, and in quite ambiguous terms actually, that the Protestant and the Catholic Church would find their right place in the Reich, and that he knew how important they were. And if you read this text, it's in the book, The Persecution of the Catholic Church in the Third Reich, you will see that if you read between the lines, you can see that Hitler is basically saying there are certain limits and you can't overstep the lines that I set. And so he managed to calm the bishops, and Cardinal Bertram wrote to Hitler and somehow tried to point out to him that he had made and had made a commitment. And he said, you pronounced yourself in favor of protecting the inviolability of the teachings of the faith and the unchangeable tasks and rights of the church. And he also added a paragraph in which he made clear that the church does not retract or alter its earlier condemnations of the religious and moral errors of Nazism, but he said he trusted that they no longer would be needed. And of course, the Nazis could not be happy with such a condemnation of their ideology, because they wanted everybody to just submit to them. And then what was next was the famous signing of the Reichskonkordat, the concordat between the Vatican and the Hitler regime, on July 20th, 1933. And Pope Pius XI later wrote in his encyclical Mit brennender Sorge that they were already planning for a concordat with any German government that would came to power, even before the Nazis came to power, and even before people could foresee that this would happen. And when he made the concordat with the Nazis, he said that he agreed to do that after although having had grave misgivings beforehand. So the Pope already knew what was going on with the Nazis. And the German bishops soon came out to condemn Nazi brutality, even in the first half of 1933. For example, Cardinal Schulte, Archbishop Klein, and Cardinal Bertram, who pointed out that former state officials of former governments had to endure the most bitter sufferings through no fault of their own. And the Nazis were always against political Catholicism, and this was like their hobby horse, even later on, which they continuously brought up. And this specifically refers to the Zentrumspartei, the center party, which was basically a Catholic party that came, that was founded in the 19th century as to represent German Catholics. And also on May 6th of the same year of 1933, the Bavarian bishops expressed their misgivings about the Nazi government and made it clear that justice and charity towards all people was an obligation. And Cardinal Faulhaber, the Archbishop of Munich Freising, asked Hitler to release the political prisoners because already in March 1933 they opened, I think it must have been the first concentration camp, which was Dachau near Munich. And Pope Pius XI in the same year, in September 1933, addressed the German Catholic youth that were on a pilgrimage and said to them, it is a historic hour for Germany, but also a hard one. And he added that they would understand what he meant.
Now let's go back just a bit to the 1933 Concordat, which was negotiated by Eugenio Pacelli, the main Vatican nuncio to Germany at the time, because critics of Pius XII and critics of the Church in their actions in Germany argue that the Concordat defined church and state relationships in such a way that it made Catholics and their leaders unable to act whenever the Nazis would take actions against Jews and the like. So is that the case, or is there another story there?
I cannot really say that the Concordat would have been somewhat detrimental to or would have put a gag on the church to speak out against Jews. The fact is that the Nazis quite frequently just violated this Concordat on their side. They totally didn't care about it at all. If anyone spoke out against them, and I think there's nothing that prohibited this in the Concordat, they would have dealt with them probably in the same way. I don't know if there was something in the Concordat that would permit this. I can only say that the Concordat is more of a religious document, and actually, just as I said, that it was basically meant for any German government that would come into power. And so, of course, nobody could foresee that the Nazis would unleash a mass persecution against Jews. And in my personal opinion, no priest or bishop would be bound in conscience to observe a concordat that would forbid him from condemning grave moral issues, and that certainly wasn't the case. I cannot say that there's anything in the concordat that would prohibit them from speaking out against injustice, because obviously this would be against the Catholic faith to gag bishops and priests that way.
Certainly. Now, most studies of the NDSAP focus squarely on anti-Semitism, and it's often pointed out that many members of the SS and the military were Catholics. Was there any Nazi propaganda directed against the church? If so, did opposition to the church increase as Hitler's government progressed? What kind of methods did the Nazis use?
Well, Nazism was of course, as the German bishops had said, there were issues with Nazism that couldn't be overlooked. And one particular was that although there were Catholics in the lower ranks of the military, the SS was quite different. And for example, SS members were not allowed to leave their barracks without a uniform and to enter a church with a uniform. So it was basically impossible for them to attend church during the 3 years of their barrack training. And additionally, duels were mandatory. The SS members had a right and the duty to defend their honor in a duel, which of course again is incompatible with Catholicism. And there was quite a movement of SS members leaving the church in 1936. It was a great propaganda campaign of leading Nazi figures leaving the church or the Protestant church as well. And for example, quite a number, like I think it was around 200 members of the SS Corps that was serving Dachau concentration camp left the church in 1936. And there was massive Nazi propaganda directed against the church. Coming back again to the SS, which ran a newspaper, it was a weekly newspaper called Das Schwarze Korps, the Black Corps. It was the SS newspaper. It was a disgusting rag with anti-Catholic propaganda probably in every issue. And it was nonetheless Germany's most read weekly and had a run of 750,000 issues in 1944. And this weekly ridiculed the church and all of its beliefs, basically. They would write blasphemous articles about the sacraments. They would even use anti-Catholic cartoons from Red Spain, from the communist-controlled parts of Spain during the Civil War, and would publish them in their newspapers, although they were enemies of, or supposedly they were enemies of the communists. And they often, their recurring topics in this newspaper were the supposed allegiance between Bolshevism, Freemasonry, Judaism, and the Vatican. And you often saw cartoons of, take for example, Cardinal Pacelli walking into a church in Paris while the communist is holding his Kappa Magna, and below it says two rats. And Cardinal Pacelli says to the communist, "Thank you, dear friend. I will bless you later on." And this was one of the more harmless cartoons. They made really lewd jokes about the confessional, where you see a friar looking out of the confessional, looking like a lust-filled pervert, and looking at some type of blonde German girl, which responds, "Oh, Father, I don't even know the sins that you are asking me about." And this one, I could go on for only 4 hours about those really disgusting articles that they issued, but I think your readers will get an idea. And this newspaper was spread all over Germany, and of course it wasn't the only Nazi newspaper that attacked the church. There was the Völkische Beobachter, there was the SA-Mann, and there was also the magazine or the newspaper of the Hitler Youth, run by Arthur Baldur von Schirach, who was actually three quarters American, and he was I think from Protestant family, and they gravely mocked the Pope by saying, well, the Pope has to teach a married couple about marriage, but how should he do that with after having lived in celibacy and all of those typical anti-Catholic vitriol. And another main factor was the push for a community school that wasn't denominational. Back then, there were still strong Catholic schools in Germany all over, and also Protestant churches. And this was also stipulated by the Concordat, that there would be denominational schools for Catholics. Nonetheless, the Nazis exerted public pressure on all those that still supported this those Catholic schools, and blamed those people for being divisive and not being in favor of national unity, and they would pressure people into signing their like lists or referendums in favor of the community school, the non-Catholic schools, where Catholic children and Protestant children would attend the same classes and would only get in some type of religious classes that would, of course, be given by a Nazi teacher. And they exerted pressure on people by threatening them with economic problems that they would later on suffer if they didn't sign, or job loss. And some Catholics gave in to this, but when the elections that the Nazis actually did for these at this community school, when they held those and they were free, the parents overwhelmingly voted in favor of the denominational schools. And so the Nazis couldn't use this whole election campaign in their favor, and instead got rid of the Catholic schools by decree. And the schools were simply dissolved by the authorities, and by 1939, there were no more Catholic elementary schools in the mostly Catholic regions of Bavaria, of Baden, of Austria, of the Saarpfalz, and all in all, 10,000 Catholic elementary schools had been abolished by then. And you certainly get the picture of the effort it takes to destroy all those Catholic elementary schools, and what hatred it takes against religion. Other methods the Nazis would use, and this would take place during the war, when Hitler actually commanded that there should be no actions taken against the church till the end of the war, because of course the Nazis thought that they would win the war, and after that they would be able to totally finish off the church. There would be no longer a Catholic church, or at least there would no longer be a Catholic church that would be any threat to their government or to their ideology. And the Nazis started to sack monasteries, abbeys, convents that they confiscated, and often the reasons they gave for this expropriations of religious houses were extremely ridiculous. There was, for example, a Capuchin monastery in Bludenz in Austria, and they said that, well, this house was in the way, so they just tore it down or whatever they did with it. And they also made money from these expropriations. For example, when they expropriated St. Ottilien Arch Abbey in Upper Bavaria, which was run by the missionary Benedictines, they took all the money from the missionary association work of charity of St. Benedict. And in other monasteries, they would take the money that was given for mass stipends. In a Benedictine priory in Bregenz in Austria, they stole chalices and monstrances, and they even made a priest empty the ciborium into another ciborium in another church, and then he would have to return the empty ciborium, and the empty vessel would then be confiscated by the Nazis. There were also massive attacks on cloisters in the new western parts of the Reich, which the Germans had actually annexed. For example, in Luxembourg, they drove out nuns, and they weren't very careful because the nuns were then sent to the neighboring German diocese of Trier, and the people started to ask themselves what's going on in Luxembourg, because they had all those religious sisters coming into their diocese from Luxembourg that were obviously being driven out of their convents. And the Nazis also drove out the Bishop of Metz in Lorraine and a number of his canons. And what was even worse, what they did in the East, in the new next parts of what was Poland. One example, the most extreme example, is the so-called Wartegau, which is the area around Poznanie in Poland, which was, of course, majority Polish, a German minority, and this was to become the model Gau, as they were called, those political regions of in the sense of states in the United States, or what we have today in Germany, the Bundesländer. And they went on to destroy the church in Wartegau by the most perfidious acts. They assassinated a great number of the Polish priests. They abolished almost entirely all religious services. I think religious masses could only be attended on Sundays. And there was, I think it was between 8 and 11, where people could attend church and could go to confession, could have their children baptized, could be wed, could be and hear mass, of course. And the priest had to administer the sacraments to all those people between 8 and 11, and also had to finish mass on time. And what the Nazis did was to totally abolish the church as a public body in the Wartegau and turned it into some type of association which only adults could join, and priests would have to have a regular job. They could no longer live off their priestly service. And also churches were confiscated, and I think by 1941 it was, there were only four priests left in the whole of Poznania, a city that then had 200,000 inhabitants. They had four priests for 200,000 inhabitants, of whom most were Catholics, And what they also did was to segregate German Catholics and Polish Catholics. They could no longer attend the same church services, and they would also, the Polish sermons were banned altogether. And another major factor, there were numerous religious newspapers and magazines in Germany before the Nazis came to power, many of great quality, many great specialist theologian magazines, missionary magazines, and the Nazis went on to destroy the entire Catholic press, basically, in Germany, and there were only a few magazines and newspapers left that would survive this this phase of religious persecution.
Fascinating. And I will have some of the propaganda you spoke of linked up in the interview notes. And actually, interestingly, there's one I saw a few years ago that shows Eugenio Pacelli, the future Pius XII, together with the classic example of an anti-Semitic depiction of a Jewish woman with a giant nose,
yeah,
and those sorts of things.
Yeah.
And it says on the wall, I had to get a dictionary out and work on it. I haven't spoken or done much with German in a number of years, but I had to get a dictionary out and look at it, and it basically said, on the wall, it said Nazi gas, and Pius Pacelli was getting close to the Jewish woman, and it said, what will they cook up next? And there's all this chemistry and alchemy about different things of that nature. So this is very interesting. And of course, so this is not exactly painting the picture of Hitler's Pope or a particularly compliant church. So what was the immediate impact of Mit Brennen in der Sorge? Because it's the only papal encyclical to be written in German and promulgated in German. It didn't mention Hitler or the NDSAP by name, yet Hitler wasn't exactly pleased by it.
No, not at all, of course. And the Pope was quite clear, although using pretty general terms. And before I get into the encyclical, I would get back to what you just mentioned, the whole depiction of Jews. And they often try to make cardinals look like Jews. Most Italians have a more or less prominent nose. And they, of course, said then Pope Pius XI is a half-Jew, and they even tried to, they basically photoshopped a Cardinal August Hunt, I think he was then the Archbishop of Poznania in Poland, to make him look like a Jew. And that was were some of the methods that they would use. So, getting back to the encyclical Mit Brennen der Sorge, which Pope Pius XI issued on Passion Sunday in 1936, you can only really basically marvel at what the Pope knew about the situation in the Catholic of the Catholic Church in Germany. And even before issuing that encyclical, he had often mentioned what great concern the situation of the Catholic Church in Germany caused him. And he had this encyclical has a wonderful structure, especially in the German version, where it has various subheadings, so you can see the structure a little more clearly. And he starts by thanking the German bishops for visiting him during his illness, and he then expresses his deep sorrow about the state of the church in Germany and the frequent attacks launched against her. And he then made it clear, in no uncertain terms, that the Nazis were trying to destroy the church from the start. And he then goes on in the body of the encyclical to condemn all important Nazi errors, especially in regard to religion, because some people might say, well, the Nazis said they believe in God, so they can't be that much against the church. And what they often did was to use God and the universe or the natural movement of the universe. They used God just like, yeah, more basically natural powers. And he condemned that and then went on to point out that all have to believe in Christ, and if you all believe in Christ, you have to believe in the church he founded, and there couldn't be a national church, because that was what the Nazis were trying to do in Germany as well. There were the so-called Deutsche Christen, which was basically just a Nazi offshoot. I think it didn't have anything to do with Christianity except for the name. And he went on to condemn all Nazi errors in regard to religion, and then exhorts the priests to stay steadfast in the faith, and while being merciful and charitable, they shall not forget to proclaim the truth, quote-unquote, whole and entire. And they should fight for the rights of the church and condemn error in any and every form. And he said otherwise they would be traitors to God and to their holy vocation. And he then, before that even, he exhorts the German youth to stay faithful, even though they find themselves in a very difficult situation, because back then I think all German youth had to participate in some type of Nazi youth organization, either the Hitler Youth or the Bund Deutscher Mädel, which was the Nazi girls group, basically. And he then exhorted the German Catholics to distrust the Nazi education, because by then they had already launched this campaign against the Catholic churches, and they should distrust the enemy that covers up his real goals and would still give religious Catholic religion classes in school, but at the same time was destroying the faith of the children's and the children's hearts. And the result of this encyclical was that the Nazis, of course, were infuriated, and they came down hard on anyone who dared to spread the encyclical. In a letter by a Gestapo official in Munich, he referred to the encyclical as a highly treasonous attack on the state, and all copies were to be confiscated. All persons responsible for its distribution outside of churches and parish buildings, with the exception of the clergy, were to be arrested immediately. It is interesting that they say without the exception of the clergy, because I have read about one priest who was sent to prison for 15 days for simply reading the encyclical from the pulpit. And if those people that distributed the encyclical happened to be party members, they would lose their membership immediately. And what was especially hard for Catholic publishers was that their publishing houses would be confiscated if they printed the encyclical. And there was one very bizarre case of the publishing house Valentin Höfling in Munich, which didn't really have anything to do with the encyclical. They didn't even print it, but the owner was still, I think he was heavily fined. The building was taken away, and he hadn't even printed the whole thing. And other publishing houses that, in fact, had printed the encyclical were also expropriated. And this was basically the attack of the Nazis, because they probably couldn't counter what the Pope said in his encyclical. They couldn't even come up with arguments against that, because when you read Nazi propaganda on religion, you will see that it is the most ridiculous and cheap, really nonsense, what only 15-year-old atheists would believe. And so this was probably too much for them, and they could only win by using force.
Well, it sounds a lot like various measures we see today, budding, you know, in the United States, especially, and also in Western Europe. You know, you criticized Islam, so we're going to fine you. There's this movie maker that had made a video critical of the Islamic religion, and he was jailed. He was a Maronite Catholic, I think, right around the time of the Benghazi attacks in Libya, and then the administration promptly blamed him for those attacks, even though there was no evidence to that effect. You know, other groups, there's laws in effect, of course, that can be things, you know, they can basically put you in jail for speech. You know, it's slowly encroaching again in the West, these very same measures, it seems, that the Nazis had put in place. So then, well, it's generally known now that Pius XII wrote the encyclical Mit Brennen und Ersorge, or at least assisted in its writing. Pius XI dies, and he becomes the Pope. How did the Nazis see this development?
The Nazis, from the get-go, I think they never liked Cardinal Pacelli, even though some might now say that he was in fact Hitler's Pope, but this is absolute nonsense. And Pope Pius XII wrote letters to his friend Bishop Graf von Preising. He was the Bishop of Berlin during that time. He was totally against Nazism, one of the most combative bishops against Nazism. And it's quite clear from the correspondence that they have that Pope Pius XII knew what was going on, and that he did, in fact, do much to counter the Nazis, and he probably did more than he said, and this is what people often use against him. He was not very vocal, but he did plenty to rescue the Jews, and he even explained in a letter to Bishop von Preising why he acted that way, why he didn't speak out against the Nazis. This was a letter from dated April 30th, 1943, so it was well into the Nazi regime. He said he exercised such restraint in speaking or writing, ad majora mala vitanda, to avoid greater evil, because the Pope knew very well what could happen. For example, if he spoke out against the persecution of the Jews, he would have known that the Dutch bishops did the same, and nonetheless the Nazis deported countless Jews in the Netherlands, and especially also Catholics of Jewish descent, because the Nazis said, well, look, if the bishops protect these Catholic Jews, they must be the worst Jews of them all. And Pope Pius XII wrote against the Nazis in a secret papal letter, in which he had delivered by smuggling priests basically to the Archbishop of Krakow, Count Adam Sapieha, in 1942. And this letter was entitled The Ideological Examination and Refutation of National Socialism. And when the Archbishop, when Archbishop Sapieha opened the letter and had a look, he said, he threw up his hands in horror and said it was impossible to publish this letter that the Pope had written, because the Poles would even receive more reprisals at the hands of the Nazis. And at that time, keep in mind that many influential Poles and among the many priests had already been killed by the Nazis, and the church life, as I have mentioned earlier, was heavily restricted. And and this whole story with this letter, Archbishop Sapieha said to one of the priests that smuggled this papal letter, Monsignor Quirino Paganuzzi, he said to him that the Polish people and the Jews think that the Pope didn't care about them, but they didn't know that they have withheld the encouragement sent by the Pope in order to avoid even greater reprisals by the Nazis. And they obviously, the Pope wrote in favor of the Jews or of persecuted Polish Catholics, but the bishops at that point of time deemed it more prudent to not release the letters of the Pope. And one thing that was... I think betrays the Nazi position towards Pope Pius XII, that he wasn't really their pope, was that I think a couple of years ago there was this news story about SS paratroopers planning to kidnap Pope Pius XII in the last year of the war, I think it was. And personally, coming back to your question, the reaction of the Nazis towards the Pope, towards Pope Pius XII, I think there was no particular reaction at that time, because it was already quite clear that the Nazis were going against the church and were going to destroy it, no matter who was the Pope, whether it was Eugenio Pacelli or his predecessor, Cardinal Ratti, even before that. And therefore, I haven't found any substantial complaints and especially no praise of Eugenio Pacelli becoming a pope, especially with the cartoon that you've already mentioned. There wasn't really a great, there weren't really many fans of Pope Pius XII in Germany by then, with all the propaganda that they would be indoctrinated with in Germany.
Indeed, no love lost there. So,
no.
As we noted before, that when we study, because you mentioned, of course, when Dachau was founded, the studies about the concentration camps focus exclusively on the Jewish suffering there in the Holocaust. Yet, Catholics and Protestants went there in great numbers. And so, what was the size of the contingents of Catholics that were and Protestants as well that were sent to the labor camps? And you know, what was their public profession? And I'm sorry, was the public profession of the faith enough to get you sent there, or did you actually have to take some action against the government?
There were different reasons for which you could be sent to the concentration camps in Germany, or also being just generally persecuted. Mostly it was just being vocal about certain aspects that the Nazis didn't like. And it wasn't like in Spain during the Civil War where just owning a rosary could get you killed, or having a crucifix at home could get you killed, or simply being a priest, or having the reputation of being a very holy priest could get you killed. It was a bit of a mix. There were certainly people that were killed simply for being Catholics. One very prominent case is that of Dr. Erich Klausner, who was the leader of the Berlin Catholic Action Group. He also was involved in center party politics, and for being such a important Catholic politician, he was assassinated during the time of the Röhm Putsch, the coup or the whole cleansing that they did after the Röhm Putsch, when when Hitler more or less suppressed the SA because they became too powerful, or wanted to become more powerful within the Nazi state in 1934. So the officers that killed him did not actually know that he was being killed for being a political Catholic. They sent SS guards there, had him shot, and until then they only knew that this was about this whole SA thing, and then a superior said, this is a very dangerous Catholic politician and he had to go. And they even staged it to look like a suicide. It was basically a character assassination, because you would really damage the reputation of this man by staging some type of suicide. Mostly, I think it was mostly priests who would go to concentration camps and prisons. And there you see that Catholics were the vast majority of religious prisoners in the concentration camps. I think about 95%, I've got the numbers on my blog, Die Verfolgung der katholischen Kirche unter dem Hitler-Regime. I think 95% of the prisoners, of the religious prisoners, of the religious ministers, so to say, that were imprisoned in Dachau were Catholics. There were 2,579 Catholic priests out of 2,720 clerics. So Protestants weren't really numerous if you take into account that, I think still then, Germany was a majority Protestant country with about two-thirds of the population being Protestant, if I'm not mistaken. And during the 12 years of the Dachau concentration camp, 1,035 priests died there. And you have to take into account that the priests only started to be sent to Dachau by around 1940. So you see the persecution progressed towards the end of the Nazi regime. And you could basically be sent to prison for saying rather harmless things. One priest, I think, was even sentenced to death for saying something to the effect of that the one who he was talking with really thought that it was so difficult, that it was so easy to kill Hitler, and the judge and the prosecutors want to make it look like that he was saying, I'm basically in favor of Hitler being killed, although he hadn't said that at all. There was one priest in Franconia who was sent to prison for all kinds of offenses that didn't really have anything to do with the Nazi government directly. For example, he gave food to Polish slave workers that were working around his in the town where he was a parish priest, and this was enough to get him sent to Dachau, because then they started to put forth all kinds of accusations of things that he supposedly did, of speaking against the Nazis. And this was the first priest that was sent to a concentration camp in Dachau, Fritz Seitz. He actually survived. And Polish priests, I think, were simply sent for being Polish priests. So there you see the mix. There was a bit of a mix of simply persecuting people for being Catholics or for speaking out, because there were other priests that were definitely vocal about their opposition towards Nazism. For example, Blessed Pater Jakob Gapp, he was an Austrian Marist priest who was absolutely anti-Nazi, and he had to flee. Or he left Germany and worked in Spain for some time after the Civil War, and they used a perfidious method to catch him. Two people approached him and said they were Jews who were being persecuted, and if he could help them. And then they somehow lured him across the Spanish-French border into what was then Nazi-controlled Vichy France. And he was later on brought to Berlin to be executed. And during his trial, he made it perfectly clear that he would combat Nazism during the rest of his life. There were also other issues which could land, which could get you into prison or into concentration camp. There were two priests in particular that could be called somewhat martyrs of marriage. It was Father Otto Neuruhrer and Father Georg Heffner, who both condemned either divorce or marrying a divorced man. And Father Neuruhrer was a parish priest in Tyrol and warned a young woman against marrying the friend of the Gauleiter, the boss of the Nazi boss of the Tyrol state government, and because he had already been married. And due to the connections this man had with the Gauleiter, Father Neuruhrer was then imprisoned. He was sent to the concentration camp, I think, in first to Dachau and then to the concentration camp in Buchenwald, where he died in May of 1940 for having taught catechism to a man who wanted to be baptized. And Father Neuruhrer was hung, they hung him by his feet for 34 hours, and he then died due to all the blood pressure in his head. And there was also Father Georg Heffner, who was the parish priest of a little town near Würzburg in Bavaria, and he asked a dying party member to write a public condemnation of his divorce, because that was the motions that you would have to go through back then if you would incur some type of penalty, canonical penalty, for being able to later receive a Catholic funeral. So he had, this man had to write a public condemnation of his divorce, and Father Georg Häfner just did his job by following the protocol, and he was then sent to Dachau in December of 1941 and died of hunger in August 1942. What's actually very interesting is that although they often had to be very careful about doing any pastoral care in the prison camp, they managed to have a chapel in the block 26 of the concentration camp in Dachau, where there was even a priestly ordination, and the ordination of Blessed Karl Leisner, which is, I think, one of the most moving stories from the Dachau concentration camp and from the priest's block, as they call it. He was a deacon at the time of being imprisoned and had been sent to a sanitarium in the Black Forest region for being cured from some type of lung disease. And he made critical remarks about Hitler to someone he was speaking to over dinner, I think. And he was arrested in 1940. And by 1944, his health had seriously deteriorated, and he had was suffering from incurable tuberculosis. And at the same time, Monsignor Piquet, the Bishop of Clermont in France, was sent to the concentration camp in Dachau for having helped Jews. And through some secret channels, they managed to bring the missorial papers from the Diocese of Münster to Cardinal Faulhaber in Munich, who was the ordinary of Dachau, basically. And Cardinal Faulhaber provided the necessary oils for the ordination, and all those things were smuggled by two brave young women or girls, even though they knew that they could be executed for these smuggling actions. One of them, I think their names deserve to be made public beyond Germany. One of them was, she was then 20 years old, was Imma Mack. She later became a sister, a religious sister, and died in 2006, I think it was. And a young girl, I think she was only 11 years old, was Christel Steinbüchler. And they smuggled those holy oils and the documents into the concentration camps, basically with being threatened with death if they were discovered. And in the priests and the religious in the concentration camp made all that was necessary for the ordination mass, the pontifical vestments, the crozier, and the chasuble for Father Leisner. And in all secrecy, they then went on to ordain him, or the bishop went on to ordain him on December 18th in 1944, and he celebrated his first and only mass on December 26th. In the same year, and he died shortly after the liberation of the concentration camp and was later beatified by the church. And one of the most heroic acts probably was the care of the dying, because many people were suffering from serious illnesses due to malnutrition or even due to human experiments. There were priests that were injected with the malaria virus, and they were basically testing certain diseases on priests. And those priests risked their lives when caring for their dying for the other dying prisoners.
There's, I'm sure, many more amazing stories like that. But in general, we don't hear about these particular martyrs or the heroic sacrifices of, you know, these, you know, with the exception of a Blessed Titus Brandsma, a little bit, if you know Carmelites. The one of the only martyrs of the Holocaust that everyone's more familiar with is Teresa Benedicta of the Cross, or St. Edith Stein. So, and of course, she's a Jewish convert. Do you feel that the church has not done the research to promote these various martyrs for beatification because there is a sense, whether announced or not announced, that, okay, no, this is just a Jewish thing. We're not going to allow you to encroach upon it. Such as when the Carmelite nuns had set up a chapel at Auschwitz to pray for the victims, and it became very controversial, and eventually the Israel asked for them to be booted out because this is a Jewish shrine, let no Catholics come.
Indeed, that's a very interesting aspect. And certainly there were other Jewish martyrs, other Catholic Jews who died in the concentration camps, and they, I think, weren't beatified either. There was a group of seven siblings, the children of two Jewish converts, who all became members of the Trappist order. And there were all Trappists in the Netherlands, and they were all deported, and I think all of them died. And I don't think that they have been beatified. There are very few, and as you've mentioned, there are very few Catholic martyrs that have been beatified in this particular persecution, whereas when you look at Spain, you have mass beatifications, and I'm very interested in this topic because it was a glorious period for the church. The heroism of the Spanish Catholics was really beyond compare. And I think the Germans, I cannot really say that this might be an issue with the Jews. It possibly is, because in Germany you always have to be very careful with what you say. And they also often try to make the bishops from those times look bad for having said something that before Vatican II was still rather normal for a bishop to say, that, well, the Jews need to accept the Catholic Church and Christ, of course. And what I think is a big problem is a lack of knowledge, basically, in Germany of this whole period of persecution, that many Catholics have really forgot about the martyrs. And I think it was the famous German Jesuit Karl Richstetter who said that if a people forgets about its saints, this is really a bad sign when it comes to the religious situation of this people, of this particular people. And I mean, it's not a secret that the church in Germany and in Europe as a whole, in the world as a whole, is in a horrible crisis. And I think a part of this crisis is that people and Catholics don't really care about what was before the 1960s, and really don't care about their persecuted, especially here in Germany, where this topic is, just as I've mentioned, very touchy, because you have always to keep in mind that the general view is that this was mainly persecution of the Jews. And in my opinion, this might be a problem that most Catholics don't dare to speak about our martyrs in the light of the millions of Jews that lost their lives during the Third Reich. And I also think it's a problem, the lack of knowledge about this period. And I hope I can make just a small contribution to people really look into this more deeply. And there are excellent books that have been written on this. Unfortunately, most of them are in German. One is very interesting. It's a book by Benedicta Maria Kempner. She was the wife of the chief persecutor at the Nuremberg trials, and she made a book about the priests, or about the German priests and priests from other nationalities being persecuted before Nazi courts. So if only the German bishops or whoever was in charge had a look at those books and try to go further in this and the beatification processes of some of them, this would really be, I think, of great spiritual would be a great spiritual improvement for Germany. And there has also been an ecumenical quarrel about the beatification of three Catholic priests that were executed together with a Lutheran pastor, and when they were beatified, they are called the Lübeck martyrs after the city of Lübeck in the north of Germany. When they were being beatified, there was a major uproar because this Lutheran pastor, of course, wasn't beatified, and now they. I've read an article where it says, yeah, basically they were ecumenical. This was an ecumenical martyrdom because their blood mingled, and there you see the problems that arise from having those martyrs beatified. And often enough, when there are beatification processes, I think. Take, for example, Cardinal von Gahn, who was very vocal against the Nazi regime. He was viewed rather critically for being very conservative and somewhat nationalist. So you have to really avoid a number of problems when going through these beatification processes.
Indeed, and I guess that recalls what happened when they canonized St. Maximilian Kolbe. And, of course, within a month of that, they pulled up old editions of his newspaper and said, look, he's an anti-Semite because he said Jews needed to be converted and warned about Freemasonry and other things. And it was a very politically incorrect beatification that John Paul II had pushed through because of the Polish connection there, which is perhaps the only reason that was put through. But who knows? So the very last thing is, how did Germans and German Catholics today view the church during Hitler's regime? And how favorably would they look upon the beatification of priests martyred during this period?
I think that since the church is generally viewed negatively in Germany, I'd say the overall opinion is a negative one. You always, I've often seen a picture of two bishops, I think they were Austrian bishops, of making the Hitler salute, and those things are being perpetuated, and then there was one Nazi priest or one abbot that was in favor of Nazism, while thousands of priests went to concentration camps, to Nazi prisons, were being executed for opposing Nazism. And it is interesting that the the general perception has somewhat changed after the war. In the first years after the war, Catholics generally didn't really speak that much about those topics or the role of the church in Nazi Germany. And although the German bishops had come out with a statement and basically apologizing or saying that some Catholics had surrendered to the errors of Nazism or had remained indifferent or even became criminals themselves. And this was right after in 1945, I think. And also Pope Pius the 12th and then condemned what was is generally called Kollektivschuld, the collective guilt of Germans. And this was probably the only thing what was really an issue until the 1960s, when Hochhuth came out with his play The Deputy. And I think many people, at least in Germany, have their negative perception of Pope Pius XII from this play. Hochhuth was supposedly sponsored by or supported by communists from the Soviet Union. I think the director of the play was a communist, and so Pope Pius XII got this rap of being Hitler's pope, I think mainly due to this play. And then by the 60s, this whole discourse had changed. In 1965, Cardinal Dutzen of Munich came out and said the media is biased. There was a one-sided bias that only focused on the church, while other institutions were also put before the choice of being accomplices or being part of the resistance towards Nazism. And then from 1979 onwards, there was an added interest in the Holocaust. After the documentary series The Holocaust came out, the general discussion about the Third Reich was dominated by the persecution of the Jews. And Dr. Karl Josef Hummel, who is a member of a Catholic lay group called Commission of Contemporary History, they also write books about the Nazi regime, and said that in the last 20 years, and he was writing in 2006, historians who provided new insights and as a result actually unburdened the church and showed that there was resistance had to face the criticism of being apologists, of downplaying the role of the church in being in favor of Nazism probably, and of simply telling fairy tales. And the works of the church in favor of Jews, for example, were belittled. For example, there was one lady who was in charge of a rescue service for Catholic Jews in Berlin. Her name was Dr. Margarete Sommer. This was really, she was really disparaged, or her work was disparaged because critics said they only focused on Catholic Jews, and the church was serving its self-interest. And I'd say, in general, the public perception, this negative turn in the last 50 years didn't change a lot. And during my research, I found two articles from the Spiegel, or rather it was one article from the Spiegel, that is Germany's major weekly news magazine, and the Süddeutsche Zeitung, which is one of the largest daily newspapers, and they had articles about the church in the Third Reich, which were either telling half-truths or had an anti-Catholic undertone. So in summary, I would say that even though in retrospect one might be tempted to say that the Catholic Church could have done more, the examples of the martyrs and their heroic faithfulness and the heroic faithfulness displayed by many Catholics during those hard times by far outweigh the shortcomings, if there were. The human factor in the church is always there, and I guess there were shortcomings, but you also have to take into consideration the pressure on Catholics and speaking out against the persecution of the Jews didn't prove to be very helpful, as could be seen with the example of the Dutch Jewish Catholics that were deported after the Dutch bishop spoke out. And I personally hope that the blessed martyrs may intercede for us and that their lives may serve as an example for us in the times of persecution that might be closer than we all wish or want to realize.
Indeed, certainly. Well, Constantine, thank you for joining us today with a fabulous presentation on this.
Okay, thanks, Ryan. It was great